now, if you are the Watson, as I see, actually what his master at Waterloo in 1984, and his PhD thesis was on block ciphers and was from Toronto in 89, if I'm not mistaken. And today we're going to hear about quantum blocks and algorithmic scale.
Thanks, Daniel. So this is mostly work that I did a couple of years ago when I was in Calgary, and it was joint with Andrew Childs, Enrico Diotto, Eddie Farhi, Sam Gutman, and Dan Spielman. And then there were some sort of updates that I'll mention along the way. So in quantum computing, so quantum walks and algorithmic speed up, and the motivation is one of the most important research questions in quantum computing is to find new quantum algorithms. We know about the screen. We know there's Shor's factoring algorithm, which is a very remarkable thing, and that's based on the quantum Fourier transform, and there are a number of other interesting quantum algorithms that use the quantum Fourier transform or some variant of it. And the Fourier transform is very good at sort of detecting sort of periodic structures and things. And there's some computational problems that can be framed in such a way that this periodic structure, detecting it, leads to the solution of the problem. Many other computational problems, don't seem to fit that structure. There's another quantum algorithm, Grover's search algorithm, which is based on another idea called amplitude amplification, which is it's a way of actually speeding up search problems by using some clever combinations of reflections, and there are many algorithms that use amplitude amplification in interesting ways. You don't get exponential speed up over classical techniques with amplitude amplification. You get essentially quadratic speed up, but it's still interesting. But there aren't many other techniques around that have really been established or shown to be pretty useful. And this is really an exploration of the technique of trying to look at quantum walks as an algorithmic technique and see what they might do and what they might not be capable of doing. So from a computer science perspective, it seems like a natural step to try to quantize random walks, because random walks have been used in a number of interesting classical algorithms. So I'll mention a couple. The first actual example for using a random walk-based algorithm is a graph theory problem where you're trying to determine, we have a graph and you want to know if there's a path between two vertices, S and T. And one way to do it, which may sound crazy, is to just do a random walk starting from S. So just with equal probability, choose one of the neighbors of S. And then let's say you land here, and now there are three neighbors. With each equal probability, choose one of these neighbors, and so on, and just walk around. And if you ever hit T, then you know there has to be a path from S to T. And the remarkable thing is that if there is a path from S to T, then after n cubed steps, you're going to find it with high probability, where n is the number of vertices in the graph. So you can sort of safely terminate after about n cubed steps if you haven't found T, and just sort of infer that, well, there probably isn't a path from S to T. There are other algorithms for testing whether there's a path from S to T, but the remarkable thing about this one is it uses very little space, because you only have to remember one or two vertices at a time. And when you take the next step, you can forget the history of where you came from. And so it actually is only logarithmic in amount of memory and still polynomial time. And if things would have been a bit different if I had given this talk 3 weeks ago. But this is really for 25 years, this is nobody has figured out how to de-randomize this algorithm. This was a case where there was no deterministic way known to test whether there's a path from S to T if you have the same space and time constraints. And well, this has sparked a lot of interesting work trying to de-randomize it and make partial progress. And something really significant happened on November 8th. It was announced that there's a deterministic algorithm that solves this problem. So you don't need randomness to solve it anymore. There are nevertheless other computational problems where random walks are used to search for things, like for combinatorial search problems, like finding a satisfying assignment for a Boolean formula. The best algorithm that's known is actually based on performing some sort of a random walk.
Yeah.
No, it's guaranteed to give the right answer. So. And yeah. So another area where random walks have been used in algorithms is not to actually find something to do some sort of search, but to actually uniformly sample some sort of set. So imagine that we have a set which given by these red dots here, and it exists in some larger space. Let's say this is the space of n-bit strings, and these are the n-bit strings that have some special property, and we'd like to uniformly sample over this set. One way we could do that is to just sample over the large set, and then check whether we happen to have been in the small set. And if we're in the small set, then we say, okay, that's the place where that's the point that we generated. And if we're not, if we're in one of the green points, then we just say, oh, we didn't succeed, so we just start the process over again. And this will do well if the proportion of red dots to green dots is not too small. But the number of red dots to green dots could be the ratio could be exponentially small, in which case this would be a terrible procedure because it would take a huge amount of time until you hit a red dot. So how do you sample? Well, another approach is to execute a random walk on some sort of graph that's related to these objects. Maybe there's some sort of way if you have one of these objects, there's a natural way mechanism for constructing variants of that object, and then there would be some underlying graph of the red things, and all the things that are in your set, there's a graph, and then the things that are outside your set, could be a graph structure there too, and then you start at some point in the red set, and then you execute a random walk, and in this case, if the degree of each vertex is the same, then the stationary distribution, well, maybe you have to have a few other properties, but the stationary distribution will be the uniform distribution. So if you run the random walk long enough, you'll approach the uniform distribution. And if the graph has some nice properties, then you'll approach the uniform distribution extremely fast. And one example of that sort of success that came out of this approach is for the best randomized approximation algorithm for approximating the permanent of a matrix is based on this kind of methodology. So we have some set of objects. Let's suppose just to make it concrete, we have what's a good example? We have some Boolean formula, and there's some truth assignments that satisfy, and there's some truth assignments that don't. And let's say we want to generate a random satisfying assignment. So we want to sample from the uniform distribution on all satisfying assignments. There may be a huge number of satisfying assignments, so it's not necessarily the method of just finding all the satisfying assignments, and then just if there are n of them, then just with probability 1 over n generating one, that might be very inefficient. And so why would one want to uniformly sample? Well, it turns out that by doing that, you can sometimes, that's helpful to approximate the size of a set. to determine the number of satisfied assignments you're moving from, for example. Yeah? Okay, the determinant of a matrix is, it's like the determinant, but on the face of it, it looks simpler, but it's actually not. So the determinant of a matrix, X, well, one way to write it is you sum over all permutations over n objects of the sign, the permutation, and then you take the use this permutation to generate a set of entries of the matrix. So X1, sigma 1. If X is an n by n matrix, well, so in order for this to make sense, this has to be meaningful as a definition of the determinant. Does that look familiar? Okay, so this is the determinant of a matrix, and some permutations have sign plus 1 and some have sign minus 1. The permanent is the same thing, except you just cross out the sign. They're all positive. Now, the interesting thing is that with the sign, there's a polynomial time algorithm for computing the determinant of a matrix, but without the sign, the problem is, it's worse than NP-hard. It's higher up in the complexity level. So it's very difficult to compute, but you can approximate it using this particular algorithm. So this is just a very brief, quick overview to just show that, well, random walks have played a useful role in the design of algorithms. So thinking about quantum algorithms, well, maybe there's some quantum. One might think, well, how do you even define a quantum walk? But it's the rough intuition is that instead of going into a probabilistic mixture of the neighbors of some vertex, go into some superposition of the neighbors. Now, that the way I just said it, that's not a meaningful definition because that won't be a unitary operation if you just literally do what I said, but something in that spirit where you spread out in superposition instead of in the mixture fashion. So let me give some definitions, some attempts to define quantum walks, because the definition isn't completely clear. Here's a way you can define a random walk that's non-standard, but it still makes sense. It's a continuous time random walk. So the time in the and imagine that what you do is you take your time and you divide it into small intervals of size of time epsilon. And in each interval, you move to one of the neighbors with probability epsilon. In each interval of size epsilon, and then if you take the limit as epsilon approaches zero, you're going to get some sort of Poisson-like process. And what it will be is you can imagine what it's going to look like. It's actually going to be like a random walk, except the clock isn't going to tick at regular steps, but it's going to tick at steps, like a Geiger count or something. It's just there'll be a certain rate of movement. Okay, so this is a meaningful definition of a random walk process, and this has a quantum analog, which works out nicely. It's I'll talk about discrete time models in a moment, but this quantum analog is to just define, instead of with probability epsilon, with amplitude I epsilon, and take the limit as epsilon approaches zero. And this process, it's not unitary, but in the limit, it approaches unitary with error only on order epsilon squared. For small epsilon, so what it really amounts to, if you evolve this process for time t, then it's like applying this transformation, e to the minus I at, to the initial state, where A is the adjacency matrix of the graph. Okay, so it's just one, if there's an edge between two vertices and zero otherwise. Okay, actually, the minus sign need not go here. It seems to be a convention. Physics stuff, so it's harmless. And this is the definition proposed by what physicists Faraday and Goodman, and they sort of played with this definition and tried to look at examples where quantum locks actually hit something faster than a random lock. I'll say more about that in a little while. So this is one notion of one way you can try to define a quantum lock. Discrete time versions have also been defined by the names listed at the bottom of the slide, and there it seems from a classical perspective it seems more natural maybe to think of the discrete time version, but in the quantum case it turns out that you need to enlarge the Hilbert space. It can't just be a process acting on the vertices of the graph, but you have to do something like, for example, adding an extra register which contains information about an orientation. So the state in any point would be a vertex where you're at and a direction where you're pointing. And then a step could be to apply some sort of operation that sort of spins the dial, maybe a diffusion operator, which is some spreads out the state. And then another operation, which would be to actually apply one step of a lock, which would be flip the direction of this, of the arrow, and the head and the tail of the arrow. And then you could just iterate that process. And that's, well, one could sort of think of that as an analog of a quantum analog of a random lock. And the orientation is sort of where you store the value of the coin that you're flipping. And it's been shown, for example, that on an unbounded line, and or for large long lines or for cycles, it's known that if you just do a classical random walk, it's going to be after n steps, it's going to be a Gaussian, the probabilities distribution of where you are on the line, and you expect that your distance from the starting point will be about square root of n. But these quantum locks, they behave in a different way. You get these interesting interference patterns, and in some sense, they spread out. They move faster. They move at rate proportional to n rather than square root of n. They'll deviate from their origin faster, which seems like a nice thing, because if you're thinking ahead of trying to devise some sort of search algorithm, you're sort of getting to where you're hoping to get faster. So it seems like a promising property. And and here's an example of an explicit example where you're actually getting somewhere faster using a quantum walk than a random walk. And this is there was an earlier example by in Faraday and Goodman's paper, but that was much messier, and so this here's a clean example. And so you want to get from S to T. Think of doing a random walk from S to T. How long is that going to take? So at each, well, vertex here, this has degree 3, so you have a probability 1/3 of going here, 1/3 of going here, and 1/3 of going here, and just imagine executing the process starting at S and just waiting until you reach T. Think of the discrete time version, I guess. And to analyze this, it'll take exponential time to get from S to T, and it's not that hard to analyze. And the reason is that you can just think of keeping track of what column you're in. And in most columns, there's a 2/3 probability that you're going to go towards the middle, and a 1/3 probability that you're going to go out from the middle. So what you're really doing is it's like this asymmetric random walk here on this line. And because of the asymmetry here, you've really got a drift going towards the center. And that means it's going to take you exponential time. And you're going to get to the middle level fast, but it's going to be hard to escape from the middle. It's going to take a very long time, because you've got this always more chance of you're sort of swimming against the strong current. But the neat thing about this, if we analyze how a quantum lock performance on this very graph, things happen differently. So a quantum lock takes polynomial time to get from S to T. And maybe I should put quotation marks around get to, because I'll say more about that later. But the point is that you can also analyze this by just keeping track of which column you're in. And the way you would do that formally is, as you execute this process by symmetry, the amplitudes in each column will always be constant along the column. So you can construct these quantum states, what we can call the column states, which is like this one state would be the uniform superposition of everything in this column. And actually, as you execute the quantum walk, you'll always be in the subspace spanned by the column states. And then you can just look at that smaller Hilbert space. If this is depth n, well, there are about 2n column states, even though the dimension of the Hilbert space is exponential in n. So you're really moving in a small subspace. And the part here that I find remarkable, and maybe from this was first explained to me by physicists, and it took me a while to get my head around this. But that when you actually analyze what's going on in the column states, it's not biased towards the middle. You get basically something like a quantum continuous. So this is the continuous time version of the quantum walk here, like a continuous time quantum walk on a line. But the amount of amplitude going left and right is the same. Even though in the original graph, it seems like you've got more opportunities to go left here than right, when you analyze things because of a sort of an interference that takes place. From the perspective of the column states, you really got the same amplitude of going left and right. And it just seems to me a little bit counterintuitive to think about that. Yeah?
Question on that, what would happen if we had, a continuous time classical walk?
It would be the same as the previous slide, because it would be just like a discrete time classical walk, except the clock wouldn't be ticking at regular intervals. So it would be just, it would still take exponential time.
Because the quantum race, your system is slightly more complicated, so it's not directly to the classical case.
I think the classical one, if you kept track of that other register, is that what you're thinking of, that other register, then it would still take exponential time. Because it wouldn't be really affecting your behavior. But in fact, the comparison here was made in the continuous time version. So the continuous time classical random walk will take exponential time, and the continuous time quantum walk doesn't have the extra register. So in a sense, I mean, I think maybe that counters your objection, but I think there's sort of a broader issue as to what this really means, and how do you really make the fair comparison that you should, I think, keep in mind. Yeah? Oh, sorry. First.
In the quantum case, how will we know when we've reached T? In the classical case, we can check every swap.
That's a good point. So that's why I said, well, we should really put quotation marks about what it means to get to. I mean, maybe intuitively you could say until you have a reasonable amount of amplitude in T, but we don't necessarily know that. So this is being rough. But you could imagine that you, I guess to make it fair, maybe this is a good time, you could imagine that you run it for a certain amount of time, and then you measure. And then as long as the probability of being at T is let's say constant or 1 over a polynomial, then we consider that you're reaching T in that amount of time. And you might not succeed because your probability isn't 1, but if you repeat the process a few times, then you're bound to reach T. So. I mean, this is another complication. In the classical case, you can passively just observe the system. But in the quantum case, once you measure it, then generally you messed up the process. Okay.
Is this a property of the exact structure of this graph, this metric, or would a graph of a sort of like this have the properties? Would that have the same indicator?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, it's a kind of, it's a delicate thing. I mean, this graph is carefully engineered to have this property. And there are graphs, like, for example, well, there are some very interesting graphs where there that relate to classical random algorithms that on the same surface, it looks like they have a little bit of the structure, but they don't really have enough that you can just apply a quantum algorithm to make things go faster. I don't know how. So it's very, it's sort of critical the way the graph is designed. Yeah?
So this mechanism is called the Bartina-Stein walk, the quantum. So when you talk about the quantum walk, it's like a Bartina-Stein quantum.
Yes.
Can you analyze the discrete type quantum walk on this?
It can be, and I think that John Watford has looked at it, and he showed that you do get this sort of this kind of collapse of the structure. Something like, it's not actually exactly like this. It's like two lines with some. It's like a ladder-shaped graph, and then presumably the discrete time quantum walk moves fast on that graph. I don't know if it's been demonstrated. So the same thing. It just doesn't seem to depend crucially on which definition of a quantum walk you use, but sometimes it makes life a lot easier or harder depending on which definition. For the purposes of this, it's actually easier to think about the continuous time walk. I don't think there's really one that sort of beats the other, one definition, but I just think depending on exactly where you are in some problem, one might be more convenient than another. But the important property for the speed up, just to get back to the previous question, is the fact that you can, at least in my mind, in my understanding, is the fact that when you analyze it, it sort of reduces to this line here. And if you had a different structure here, if you just sort of randomly perturb some of the edges, then I don't think you would have this. The hypercube. This is the 4-cube here, but and this has also been analyzed. And suppose you want to get from one vertex to the opposite side. It's a random walk will take exponential time. That's not actually too hard to see, because as you move away from the center, you have also this property that you have more edges going towards the center. And a quantum walk takes polynomial time to get from S to T. It gets there very fast. In fact, the continuous time one, if you run it for the right amount of steps, it actually is going to be at T, like with amplitude 1. So you don't have to worry about the definition. It's a very beautiful analysis for the continuous time one in a paper by Moore and Russell. It's like half a page, and whereas the discrete one was more difficult. So you start at S, you run it for a certain amount of time, and you do this at T. And measure it, and then we get T to the T, and then if we didn't measure it, then eventually you'll move back to S and T and so on. So here again, we have this phenomenon that somehow quantum walks seem to get places faster than random walks, which maybe seems like maybe they're useful for some computational purpose. So maybe there's some problem. We could define the problem, the ST traversal problem. Starting at a node S, find the another node T. And now we have to be careful how we define this problem, because for the hypercube, it's easy to find T. You just traverse each dimension once, right? I mean, so depending on how your cube is represented, if it's nicely represented, it's very easy to get from to get across the cube. So let's try to push that a little bit more. And so there are ways that people can abstractly and concretely represent graphs and problems on graphs. So when we think of a graph, we can represent a graph by just assigning a name for each node. let's say a binary string. And then the structure of the graph could be given by a table. It could be given by the adjacency matrix of the graph, but let's give what's called the adjacency list representation, which is sort of more suitable for sparse graphs. And these graphs are sparse. I mean, they have the ones in the previous slides have an exponential number of vertices, but the degree of each vertex is only, well, 3 in one case, or n in another case. So here I've just basically, this is a vertex, and then these are the names of its neighbors, so you can just find that structure on the table. There's 110, 110 here, and here are the right neighbors. And well, this is just, there's no vertex with this name, so this is just, I can think of this as null. And this vertex 101 only has two neighbors, so we can just have some coding scenario. So this is a way you could represent this picture here. And you can imagine that you're allowed to make queries to this table. So you're allowed to, you have, so let's define a kind of a black box problem, where you have some operation where you can input and vertex X, and you get the three neighbors of X, or whatever the neighbors. You get three numbers. You get information about the neighbors. I should point out that the neighbors are written in some order on the table, and so there's some implicit ordering of all the neighbors. And let's assume that we're given this information so as to be to not be helpful. Like, you just assume that you're not given an encoding where there's some special signals based on the answers encoded in the actual strings you use. So let's just say, for example, we just assigned random names to all the vertices, and we just ordered the neighbors in a random fashion. So they don't necessarily correspond at both sides of an edge, for instance, the labelings. And then the purpose one might do for doing that might be so that the table, the actual coding scheme, doesn't somehow reveal any extra information about the graph. I'm going to change the definition of a black box slightly. So here we have the three neighbors coming out, and there's no important reason for doing this, but it's just a little bit technically easier. We'll make it so that you just query the actual neighbor, and then you get that one neighbor. So you query k is 1, 2, or 3, and then you get the kth neighbor. And now we can take another crack at defining this ST traversal problem. When you're given a black box for a graph T, this kind of thing, and you're also given the name of the vertex S, and you want to know the name of this other node T, that somehow well defines what T is. And it's really like being in like the problem of finding your way through a labyrinth. It's not a physical labyrinth, it's a virtual labyrinth. And you can imagine that you start at S. Well, you look at, well, one of its neighbors is here, and then you look at this neighbor, and then you look at the neighbor, and you say, if I take this neighbor, I get back to where I started. So I found a triangle graph. And you can sort of explore the structure. Here there's a four cycle in the graph. And you can make queries, so you really only learn information about the topological structure of the graph, the local structure, by querying this black box. Especially since the names of the vertices and the orderings of things are just random, so the actual name of the vertex isn't really going to be very meaningful, but knowing that if you take one neighbor of this and another neighbor of that and this other neighbor, and you get back to where you started, that gives you information about the structure of the graph. Yeah. Oh well, you can just have some convention here, like that you, all the neighbors are just a string of all ones. Let's say. Yeah. Good question. We wouldn't necessarily know that. Because the number of nodes might be, So you basically, if you don't know, then unless you can actually reach a vertex starting from S, you don't really know that it's even in the graph. So let's assume that. So you're really, because then it really is, it's like being in the labyrinth, where you're really starting at S, and you're just sort of navigating your way from where you are and looking at the local structure and hoping to reach this special place.
I didn't get it. I thought the traversal problem is to find out whether or not there is a path.
No, there's another problem called the connectivity problem. And there you're given the graph, and that's a meaningful problem, and you're given the name of S and T. And you want to know whether there's a path from S to T. And this is something that's not quite the same, where you're just given only the name of S, and you're not given T, but the goal is to actually find the name of T.
How do you know when you reach T?
Well, it has to be well-defined in some sense. That's a good point. So in this particular graph, there are different ways in which it could be well-defined. And the hypercube, for example, if it's encoded this way, it would just be defined as the opposite vertex. That's the highest distance on the graph. And that's well-defined. And so it might be hard to find. In this particular graph, well, it happens to be such that this is the only vertex degree 2 in the graph. So you could say, find the vertex of degree 2, and that's T.
Oh, I see. So T is defined through some property. So you take a random walk on your graph. It is that you query some thing, and that tells you whether you are a T or not.
Right.
So in this case, we have a local property. If you have a local property, what is it for you? How do you then know what you can do?
Well, I mean, it's well defined because you could, in principle, if you queried all the neighbors, then you could actually reconstruct the cube, and it would be well defined. It might not be an easy way to know that you're there, but it's, in principle, it's possible. So we have this ST traversal problem, and maybe these quantum walks actually solve these ST traversal problems on those particular graphs. Pardon? It's a problem in this red box here. So you'd be given the name of S. So you'd be given 000. That's the name of S. And for this particular instance, T has degree 2, and you want to find the name of the vertex of degree 2. And we understand this coding convention that if it's a string of all ones, it's just synthesis means nil. So we know that if we happen to check this entry of the table, we see it only has two neighbors because this is sort of a nil. So it's important that this makes sense because the rest of the talk is about this talk. So let's look at the ST traversal on this graph from the child's Barry Goodman. Well, a random walk, it takes exponential time to get from S to T. And a quantum walk, well, so here I've defined hitting time more precisely. It can be shown that if you run it on order n 4 time, then it'll find T with probability 1 over n. Actually, it's a little more complicated than that. What you do is you actually choose a random termination time between 1 and n to the 4th. You run it for that amount of time, and then you measure. And then the probability that you'll be at T is at least 1 over n. So this is sort of a polynomial cost here, because even though you might not succeed in one execution, if you repeated the execution, then you'd only have to do a polynomial amount of work before you're found T. So it looks like quantum is beating classical, but the thing is, there might be a better classical algorithm than doing a random walk for this. And let's just look at that. So here's, we started S, so this is kind of a detailed analysis. For the first n steps, you're just going to reach one of the roots of the tree on the left side. And then the next step is sort of free because you don't backtrack. And now you're in an interesting situation because according to the definition of the problem, there are two neighbors. You don't backtrack. So there are two neighbors, and one neighbor is going in the right direction and one is going in the wrong direction. And you really have no idea which is which because they're just in a random order. So you pick, let's say you were lucky and you picked one going in the right direction, okay? And now there are two neighbors of this vertex, one that makes progress and one that doesn't. And let's say we're lucky again. So, good. And well, we don't expect to have a lucky streak. You know, each time we have a 50% chance of succeeding, so we don't expect to have, you know, n lucky successes in one streak, because that's very unlikely. So let's say now we're unlucky. There were two choices now, and now we picked the wrong direction. Now things kind of go badly, because now whichever neighbor we pick, and we don't really know where we are in the graph, right? We just, whichever neighbor we pick, we're just going to fall back towards the middle. Okay, so it looks like it's bad news, because unless you have a lucky streak of guesses, you're going to fall back towards the middle. But in fact, things aren't as bad as they look. This is another, you can still get through this graph. And the idea is that you know when you're at the middle, because you, the vertices at the middle only have degree 2. And they're parts of 4 cycles. So you know you're at the middle here. And then you walked around for a while, and you got back to the middle. And that's after 6 steps. And because of the structure of the graph, you can infer that you must have made the wrong turn after 3 steps. So you can sort of go back to where you made the wrong turn and make the right move there. And you can recursively apply this process. And what comes out of this is that there's a classical algorithm based on this backtracking that it only takes n squared steps that gets from S to T guaranteed. So in a way, the quantum algorithm isn't really doing anything algorithmically in terms of solving this traversal problem. It's only beating a bad classical algorithm. So I think that in a way, it's not just comparing quantum walks to random walks, it's maybe not doing more that one wants to do. So we looked at this, and then we thought, well, what about the hypercube? Well, maybe things go better in the hypercube. The promising feature about the hypercube is that all the vertices look the same, right? There's no distinct way you can distinguish the middle or any other vertex. So maybe it means that that strategy from the previous graph didn't work. And just sort of exploring these things gives us sort of a sort of a sense of what quantum walks are doing and that are interesting and what they're not doing. So how hard is it to get from S to T in the hypercube to the antifodal vertex? Oh, incidentally, on this other graph, just this T is well defined because it has degree 2 and it's not part of a 4 cycle. So this has degree 2, this has degree 2, and the middle ones have degree 2, but these are part of 4 cycles. So that other issue about how you know your F T is meaningful here. Yeah?
On that point exactly, I'm still confused. Is the quantum walk supposed to also recognize that it's T? And then how does it do that?
I mean, oh, well, it can do that. Okay.
Sure.
So here's the way you know you're at T, because you have degree 2, so you only have 2 neighbors. And you're not part of a 4 cycle, because these also have degree 2, but they're part of a 4 cycle. And you can tell whether you're part of a 4 cycle, because if you just take 2 neighbors and then test each of their neighbors and see if you reach the same vertex, then you're part of the 4 cycle. So by making a few queries in your local neighborhood, you can tell whether you're part of the 4 cycle. So you can do that test to know that you're not here, and you know you're not in S because you were given S to begin with, and so you can deduce that you must be a T.
So how are you supposed to do that? Are you supposed to stop and measure and then? I mean, I don't know.
Well, sorry, you meant?
The process, yeah. Itself,
that's after the quantum process stops. And then you're just given the name of some vertex, which is just some binary string. And then you say, well, is this T? And then you can use the black box to sort of look at the topology of the graph and then check whether you have the right properties to be a T. Yeah, you might. So in this case, you don't have the quantum algorithm. It doesn't have to do a tremendous amount of work for this particular graph. But the bad news is that, well, there's a classical algorithm that even does less work. So it's anything somehow. But the hypercube, maybe you won't have to do more work to know that you're at the antipodal vertex.
Because are you counting that into the cost?
Yeah, that counts as part of the cost. So the quantum walk, okay, so this statement here is maybe a bit misleading because, well, okay, it's not entirely misleading. Well, because the quantum walk, you have to take into account the test for knowing that you're at T. That's a fair point. That's a pretty good test. Because this is going to be the quantum walk is going to be made obsolete anyway, because there is a classical walk for getting through this, and it's just a little bit more complicated. So, I'm running out of time, so it's sort of based on a dynamic programming strategy of keeping track of certain positions. You can actually navigate your way through making only n cubed queries. Okay, and so I'll leave out the details. Okay, so it. That didn't work too well either. So that raises the question: is there a graph for which the quantum walk is able to find t exponentially faster than any classical algorithm? So to solve this traversal problem, because you need some special structure in general to get this quantum speed up. If you just draw an arbitrary graph, it probably won't happen. But if you have some special structure, well, that can also be utilized in the case of classical traversal algorithms. And in these examples, it seems that the classical algorithms can also use extra structure. So that's the question. And well, the answer is yes. There is it's possible to construct a graph. And the graph looks like this. And it's a variant of the trees. And what you do is, what's in the middle is, this is a random alternating cycle. So you can construct this part probabilistically of the graph. You just start at some vertex, randomly pick a vertex on the in this column, and then randomly pick a vertex on the left column that's distinct from one you've already been at, and then randomly pick one on the right column that's distinct from one you've already been at, and keep alternating back and forth until you eventually close the cycle. And this graph has the property that any classical traversal algorithm will take exponential time. So you'll basically, because of this business in the middle, you're going to somehow lose your bearings as you try to get through the graph. Whereas the quantum walk it still works. It gets through this modified graph. It doesn't somehow prevent the quantum walk from navigating through the graph. So just in terms of timing, when should I think about stopping at 3 o'clock? Or,
5 minutes from now.
5 minutes from now, okay. So the continuous time quantum walk, the analysis of the column subspace, it still works. There's a little sort of bump in the road here, and that is that when you actually look at what happens in terms of these columns, you get a different weight. So this will no longer be, the Hamiltonian will no longer have, the non-zero entries won't all be the same. I mean, if they were all the same, you'd have factor out root 2 constant. But you got an extra factor of root 2 here. And that complicates the analysis. But it's possible to show, and it's perhaps not surprising intuitively, that in this particular kind of weighted graph, a quantum walk will get through in a reasonable amount of time. And this graph, the analysis of this graph amounts to. And the precise theory and the result is you choose t randomly, well, I guess between zero and something that's order n to the fourth. You run the quantum walk for time t, and then you measure, and then it can be shown that the outcome is t with probability order 1 over n. And this kind of graph is one where you can actually test where you're at t, so that's not a problem. Okay, so classically, so then this shows that the quantum algorithm gets through quickly. We have to simulate the quantum walk, so there's this other issue that, well, we have this black box for the graph, but there isn't a button somewhere that we can just push that just says execute the quantum walk. I mean, we can perform queries in the black box to determine neighbors of things, but if we actually want to execute the quantum walk, we have to simulate that quantum process. And there are some issues here that I'm going to have to just sketch through. So the problem is that we want to simulate this unitary transformation for a given t on starting at vertex s, where h is it's the adjacency matrix, the graph, given the black box for g and given the start state. And there's some tools for simulating Hamiltonians, which maybe I'll just go through well, this one, let's skip this one. I mean, I'd be happy to elaborate on some of these after the formal talk. But there's some, maybe this is an interesting one. If you have, let's just look at the third one. The other two maybe you don't need to get into. But if you can simulate n Hamiltonians, like this perform this exponential, then simulating the sum is not necessarily, it would be to simulate this process. And this doesn't just, well, as I guess is obvious to people who've worked in this area, but you can't just factor this out as the product of e to the minus I h1 times e to the minus I h2, because they're not commuting in general. But there is this sort of Trotter formula or least product formula that allows you to slice things up so that you can approximate this product very well. So what do I want to say? Everything works at the, all I want to say about this slide is that things work out really fine and dandy if the labeling happens to be such that it's symmetric. So that the second neighbor of this vertex is also at the other end. That basically the labelings at both sides of each edge are the same. And we don't necessarily have that property. So just ignore the calculations for now. But if we did, things would work out fine. And then we can simulate the symmetric labeling if the graph happens to be bipartite. And these trees constructions, they are bipartite graphs. And the idea is that you can just take the, if the edge has two different labels, one at each end, they could be the same, then just take the ordered pair of the two labels, and you can somehow assign that to be the label. There's an issue that comes up, and that is, should the label of this be 2-1 or 1-2? And the bipartite structure of the graph allows you to somehow work that out so that you put things in a consistent order on both sides. So then you can reduce, in at least if the graph is bipartite, then you can reduce to that nice symmetric case, which I showed you equations that I claimed showed everything works out nicely. For arbitrary graphs, subsequent to this, Arhanov and Tasmar showed they actually solved a more general Hamiltonian simulation problem, and they showed that you can also simulate it efficiently for arbitrary graphs. And they didn't really worry too much about the size of the polynomial. There were some parameters. T is the time, epsilon is the precision, because they're not perfect simulations, but the better the precision, the more work you have to do. With some colleagues, we sort of improved this using a couple of techniques. We showed that you can reduce the n to the ninth to log star n, which is an extremely slowly growing function, much slower than log n. It's the it's essentially a constant for any practical purpose, and we could reduce the exponent of p to arbitrarily close to 1, and this is something we're still interested in understanding how to make this more efficient. But the purpose of doing this is that one consequence is that that if you employ a continuous time quantum walk, then there's going to be some overhead in simulating the quantum walk. I mean, it may take this amount of time, but then the actual simulation cost is not going to be that time, but it's going to be some expression involving that time. And here, if you can make the exponent close to 1, then it means that the cost of the simulation overhead can be made very small. So you're not really penalized by thinking in terms of continuous time quantum walks. For discrete time quantum walks, if you run it for 23 steps, then you're really just doing 23 operations. There's something proportional to 23, so you don't have to worry about this. The classical hardness. Well, I'm really out of time, but I'll just show you some pictures. I want to say that it's important to prove the hardness because We can't just say, well, I don't really know of a way to get some ST on this graph, and you know, I tried, you know, all yesterday afternoon, because it can be subtle. I mean, there's some sort of tricks. At first, you know, it may look like it's hard, but you know, there may be some way to get some ST. So here's the kind of argument, and the idea is, well, the sort of the abridged version of the proof is that when you run the algorithm, you're essentially making queries, you're essentially growing a tree on this graph. And the tree, so there's a tree. This is what the algorithm sees, this tree. And because of everything is randomly labeled, you really haven't learned anything about the graph unless you found a cycle. Because all the names of all the vertices are just random. So there's no point in, so basically an algorithm can be thought of as just constructing a tree at the beginning, and then what happens when you construct a tree is it just gets randomly embedded onto the graph. So the root goes here, this goes to one of the neighbors, and so on. It's essentially like analyzing this process, and then you can ask, what's the probability if you randomly embed this tree into this graph that it's going to hit T and or cycle? And that can be shown to be exponentially small, and therefore every classical algorithm it basically takes exponential time to get from S to Q. And there's some concluding remarks. So this can also be adapted to the ST connectivity problem. It just happens to be more convenient to phrase it this way, but you can construct a graph where you know, this problem where you're given S to T, and the problem is to determine whether there's a path from S to T, can be solved quickly by a quantum algorithm, and is provably hard for any classical algorithm. Interestingly, this solves this connectivity or traversal problem without actually finding a path. And classical random walks, I mean, they actually also find the path if they show that a path exists, because the execution of the algorithm is the path. But the quantum algorithm, I mean, it's taking all paths in superposition, and it's not actually giving one. I don't know whether for these particular trees, you can actually, these particular graphs, the two trees, you can actually find the path in S2T. I don't know how to prove that you can't either. Of course, we want to find useful algorithms that can be solved by quantum walks, not just weird-looking graph problems that we sort of made up. And Linus made some interesting progress on this recently. It's still a black box problem, but it's a sort of fairly natural element of Stinkin's problem. And I'll leave it at that. Is there any questions? Yeah?
When you originally talking about the random walk, quantum random walk, you seem to tacitly assume that it has to be given by a unitary process, but there are more general kinds of processes.
True.
So I wonder if that one's not.
Yeah.
If you did that, then you don't need, in particular, you don't need to add
an
extra degree of freedom
to the cost
of quantum time.
It's true, yeah. And people have thought about them. It seems that my rough sense is that the more mixing you allow, the more classical-like the process becomes. Sort of the interesting effects. This is with quantum algorithms, you're not really forced to make unitary operations, but the sort of the interference seems to be more interesting when you restrict to unitary. But having said that, I don't know that's enough to rule out things that are not unitary, and there may be some very interesting algorithms that are not unitary.
Does it make sense to consider classical waves propagating
across these graphs, and so why aren't they as useful as
quantum
walks?
Because there's some extra exponential resource that creeps in there somewhere.
What do you mean by classical wave?
I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. So I'm thinking.
That's why I'm still thinking.
Okay, so mathematically it might sort of be the same. I mean, if you imagine, I'm maybe guessing, but maybe you could imagine that there are these sort of little canals shaped the edges of the graph, and then you have some kind of waves going through, and you get some interference as they go through the canals. But the way the problem is framed, the graph isn't really given there. It's not explicitly there. You're just given this this black box that can be implemented unitarily that allows you to ask questions, whether the neighbors of this vertex. And so you can incorporate that into the context of some algorithm quantum or classical. And I guess you could imagine building a computer based on classical waves that would do that. So I guess it's not really a model computation that I really thought about as much.
If we think of not just whether there is a path, it's synchronous, but assuming there is one, trying to find out what the shortest path, it would get us to something like the parallelization problem, which is obviously more difficult to have. But is it clear from this perspective why it would be difficult to find the shortest path?
No. Well, we know, and for this graph, we know there's a path of length, 2n plus 1 or something. But it might be possible to find a path that's not the shortest path. It sort of goes back and forth in the middle before getting there. So that would be even harder. Sorry, I'm sort of leaving from the question. I don't really know how to. There are methods in classical algorithm design for where if you can solve the decision problem, then you can solve the search problem. So if you can determine whether a path exists, then you can determine the path itself. But that doesn't work on this graph. I've taken a random walk from your question. So you just asked whether it's harder to find the shortest path.
Yes,
and I think it could be harder. Yeah.
Assume the question is, what is the shortest in the number of steps?
Yeah, that could be harder, yeah. Well, that's for an arbitrary graph. So we're playing a different game here, because we're imposing a lot of structure on it.
The shortest path is the longest path. Right? So shortest paths are easy in graphs, because the problem here is that your space complexity is restricted. You're only allowed to memorize a constant number of vertices. And under those circumstances, shortest path becomes hard. Shortest path is polynomial time if you allow enough space. You can do it with that dynamic program.
I don't know, why do you say
you're trying to find a long path that takes out a lot of vertices. So it's more like a long path.
Yeah, but it's the shortest among those that go to all.
Yes.
I agree with the comment from Dr., but the only thing is it's not so much the space here, but it's the total amount of work that's supposed to be much smaller than the size of the graph. So the algorithm, the size of the graph is 2 to the n, and the run time should be polynomial to n.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Say,
No, I don't know. I mean, there seems to be, I've sort of explored this issue about, just compressing, into the smaller graph, and people have looked at it for other graphs, like a graph that in many computer science contexts, and I guess physics context too, that comes up is the Cayley graph, the symmetric group. And so John Watson and Keith Gerhardt had studied whether you can do something interesting with by running a quantum walk on the Cayley graph of the symmetric group, like to find the furthest point on that graph from some starting point. And it seems that you don't see that, well, the results were interesting, but mainly negative, that you don't really get the speed up that you hoped for, even though there's some structure there. Yeah?
from the classical point of view, it means that there seems to be a sharp distinction between the undirected graphs and directed graphs in terms of the light in terms of by a random walk. Has anyone looked at quantum walks on directed graphs?
And I don't think so. The thing is that the Hamiltonian needs to be symmetric. And if it's an underdirected graph, then it's not. So it doesn't, at least on the at first blush, it doesn't seem to fit very well.
It seems like we're losing a lot of examples where randomness seems to be rather comfortable and classic as the system is.
Oh, you mean the finality testing in this one? Well, it's what you said. I mean, we're losing them. There are, of course, black box separations, but ultimately, we're more at the end of the day, we're more interested in, like, in algorithms like the factoring algorithm, the quantum, which isn't a black box algorithm, and maybe someone will discover classical algorithm for that. I mean, we haven't lost too many quantum algorithms yet, I guess. There aren't too many to lose, so. there still are some important classical algorithms where the best algorithm is probabilistic for testing whether two polynomial and multivariate polynomials are equivalent, for instance.
So that's a short comment concerning your question. But there are many papers related to so-called quantum graphs in which people studied Schrödinger equation, let's say, along each bond and joining, putting appropriate conditions along vertices. Another question. Don't you think that from this perspective, it would be sufficient to find dwarfs basically computing eigenstates, eigenvalues of such a system? To find at least one eigenstate, which is simultaneously localized, let's say, inside S and T, to prove that it's connected?
Sorry, I don't understand what it means to say it's an eigenstate that's in S and T.
You have a system, like one-dimensional potential world, and here each vertex of a graph corresponds to such a sequence of waves, and they are joined. Each vertex means joining those one-dimensional systems. So it's basically a two-dimensional Schrödinger equation on such a system, and people study for a couple of years such systems and look for eigenstates, eigenvalues of such.
Yes.
So now eigenstate could be, let's say, localized in a part of the graph or entirely delocalized.
Okay.
From your point of view, the key question is if there's at least one eigenstate which is delocalized in such a way that it's localized as well in S as in T.
So you mean if there's an eigenstate that has somehow mass in S and as well as T, then that proves that S and T must be connected?
Okay, well, I don't know, it's a question.
I don't know. It's I don't know.
I'm going to try to get a little bit of a